This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. John Fogerty was the lead singer and songwriter with the band Creedence Clearwater Revival. His new CD, Deja Vu All Over Again, is being released this month, and he's also appearing on one leg of the Vote for Change concert tour, on the same bill as Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, R.E.M., and Bright Eyes. With Vietnam a hot-button issue again in the current presidential campaign, Fogerty's anti-war anthems and other Vietnam-era songs have a new resonance, and his new collection of songs plays off that history. Between 1968 and 1972, the year Creedence broke up, the group had several gold records as well as 8 top 10 singles, including Proud Mary, Bad Moon Rising, Green River, Down on the Corner, and Looking Out My Back Door. For many years, Fogerty refused to perform the songs that made him famous, because his old record company owned the rights to those songs. But in 1998, he returned to those songs on a live CD called Premonition. Terry spoke with him in 1998, when Premonition was released. Before we hear from Fogerty, let's listen to one of Creedence Clearwater's signature songs.
You've written a lot of songs inspired by the South, like Born on the Bayou. You were actually born in El Cerrito, California, near Berkeley. And I'm wondering why in some of your songs you wrote first person in the persona of a Southerner.
That's a good question. I think I realized that talking about the main street of El Cerrito probably wasn't going to be something that was widely understood or even cared about. It didn't seem very interesting to me anyway, and the South has always fascinated me, and that's really the reason, the reason that I placed myself that way in my own songs. But if you want to ask me why am I so fascinated about the South, I really have to confess I don't know.
Because of the music?
Most of what I know about the South came through music, particularly the early forms of rock and roll, meaning rhythm and blues, country blues, and country music. And again, all those versions, I believe, were pretty romanticized. They, they were sort of rainbow-colored visions of the South in most cases.
Would your father have ever said what the father says in Born on the Bayou? Papa said, "Son, don't let the man get you and do what he done to me."
He did say that a few different ways. My dad was a dreamer, unfortunately. He didn't find great success in this world. But he was quite a dreamer and pretty literate. He read all the time, and he was inspired by all kinds of people that he passed on to me in kind of little snippets. I can remember when I was very, very young, my father reading the story of Dangerous Dan McGrew over and over. He loved that particular poem. He really loved Ernest Hemingway. He was a product of the 30s and 40s, I guess. My parents certainly were Depression era people, and I learned a lot of those lessons at their knee. And I think just by the way my dad ended up living his life, just by example, really, he was telling me, don't let the man get you and do what he done to me.
John Fogerty, do me a favor. Can you say two words for me, turning and burning?
Well, when I'm sitting here quietly in a library atmosphere, it is turning and burning. But when I sing, it always comes out toinen and boinen.
Yeah. That's very New Orleans, isn't it?
Well, you know what? I didn't know where, really. Although I've noticed, because I just did it naturally. When I wrote the words, I wrote them to sound that way.
And the song in question is Proud Mary. Yeah.
Right. I've also noticed, though, that Howlin' Wolf has very much that sort of dialect in his music. I only spoke to him a couple of times, but in his singing, you know, in the great songs that he did, he pronounces those words that way. But, yes, down in New Orleans, a lot of people will say toinen and boinen.
Well, why don't we pause here and listen to your new recording of Proud Mary from your album Premonition. My guest is John Fogerty.
That's correct. Actually, we were still in the eighth grade, three of us.
Junior high school.
Right.
What were your early songs? What was the band like back in eighth grade?
Well, we were mostly an instrumental band. I patterned myself and my band very much around Duane Eddy, and we did several Duane Eddy instrumentals. Taking the pattern, basically, from Duane, I would play the melody on the guitar, and Stu, who was not yet playing bass, was playing piano, and I had kind of showed him the rudiments of, three-note chords and a little bass line. So, at that level of our development, we were certainly learning the rudiments of music, but always with a rock and roll flair, you might say. Rock and roll has some pretty strict parameters that when you step outside those parameters, everyone kind of gives you that crossed finger look, like they're holding back a vampire.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always kind of based everything from the center of rock and roll.
The band's first name was Tommy Fogerty. That's your brother, Tommy Fogerty and the Blue Velvets. And then the band was called, what was the second name?
Well, actually, originally, the three of us were the same age in the eighth grade, so we were just the Blue Velvets.
Oh.
And then we got the lucky happenstance to make a few records for a little local Bay Area label, and under that guise, Tom would join us. Tom, by that point, I think was out of high school, and, of course, we were still in high school. And, under that recording name, we were Tommy Fogerty and the Blue Velvets.
And then what was the next name that you used?
The next name on records was the Gollywogs.
And what was the Gollywogs supposed to mean?
Well, this is one of those deals, because you're young and everybody else is supposedly older and wiser, and it's their record company. What the real story is, we worked on the first song for about 9 months. I mean, we had gone in there and recorded it, and we kept pressuring the record company to, when's it coming out? This is all of 1964. And then finally they tell us, well, the record's here, the pressings are here. So we rush over. Actually, I rushed over to San Francisco, and I pull one. It's your first real record on a supposedly national label, Fantasy Records. and you want to look at this thing, and you take it out of the box, and I looked at it, and oh my God, it said the Gollywogs. So Max was one of the brothers that owned the company then. I said, well, geez, Max, there's a mistake here. There's like a typo. They put the Gollywogs. No, we decided to rename you guys. Oh, well, why? See, a Gollywog is in England, a Gollywog is like a voodoo doll. It's this doll that comes from Africa. It's really a hip thing. It's really cool. And it's black, too. It's like from the black culture. And it's really cool. It's like a voodoo doll. And in England, it's really a hip thing. Of course, in 1964, the British had arrived in America, and all things English and British, mod, etc., were very cool. Unfortunately, no one in England had ever heard of a Gollywog either.
How did you come up with the name Creedence Clearwater Revival?
Well, of course, after struggling under that name for several years, the ownership of Fantasy changed. And the very first thing we wanted to do was change our name. and the guy that had bought the company, the new owner of the company, agreed with us that we could change the name. I think he hated it too. And so we set about for many months trying to come up with a name, but none of it was very suitable or remarkable. The whole process started to bog down. I think it was Christmas Eve and I was watching television, and two commercials came on television, one of which was a beer commercial that really promoted its use of the water. And they were showing this lush green woods and this flowing river. And, you know, the place looked enchanted, and there was this beautiful music in the background. And right after that was a black and white commercial. It was an anti-pollution commercial. And it showed all kinds of pollution and garbage in the water and that sort of thing. And at the end, it said, if you want to change things, write to Clean Water Washington. And I was really taken by the two things back to back, the beautiful clear water and the, you know, terrible polluted water. And clean water stuck in my mind. I started playing with that. Clean water didn't seem like a very good name for a band, but I evolved to clear water. And I remembered back to when we had toyed at some point with the name Creedence. It's not true that I ever knew this person, but we did know of a man whose first name was Creedence. Pretty unusual name. And, of course, I shuffled that around. Clearwater, Creedence, Creedence, Clearwater. Oh, I kind of like that. But it still didn't sound complete. Remember, this is during the era of Jefferson Airplane and Strawberry Alarm Clock and Buffalo Springfield. So I kept playing around with different words, and I thought that what we were really doing was having a revival. The group, we'd been together a long time, but we were now experiencing a revival, or at least I hoped so. So finally, after about probably 10 minutes of thought or even less, I had come up with the name. And I must say that the name was much better than we were at the time.
You wrote some politicized songs that pertain to the draft and to the war in Vietnam, like Fortunate Son, which is a song about how privileged people make wars, but the sons of the privileged are exempt from fighting them. And Who'll Stop the Rain, I think, was perceived as an anti-Vietnam song. I know you were in the reserves for a while. How did you end up in the reserves?
I was a very lucky guy, really. A local sergeant in a reserve unit took pity on me and basically let me join his unit when you know, the unit was full and there was really no place for me to go. He basically took pity on me and let me get into his reserve unit at the time.
So what year was that you were drafted?
1966.
So you were already recording then?
Oh, yeah.
And you didn't want to go to Vietnam, so you ended up in the reserves. I'm wondering if being in the reserves affected your attitude toward the war or toward the kinds of songs you wanted to write.
Oh, I would say very much, because you know, you quickly learn when you become a grunt in the military that you're just a number. You're just a piece of meat. You're nothing. You have no rights. You have no privileges. You have no power over what happens to you. And that's a very debilitating feeling. And I can remember, you know what, I can remember the night I finally arrived at my boot camp after being shuffled around for a couple of days, really. And while you're still, it's your first day, and they keep you awake forever. You seem like you've been awake. And somewhere around midnight or 1 in the morning, all my guys got marched off to get our hair cut. And you kind of come back, you feel like you've been sexually abused. You know, they say, okay, go back in there. And you go back in your barracks, and there's like 30 other people in the same boat, and you're all a bunch of ugly eggheads. And I laid down on my bunk, and I must confess a few, my eyes certainly watered is, I guess, what I'm trying to say. Of course, you get over that because you're supposed to be a man. It was probably the most forlorn feeling I've ever had.
Did you see your song, Who'll Stop the Rain, as an anti-war song?
Yes.
Do you want to say anything about writing this song before we hear it?
Well, of course, the rain is a metaphor for the gobbledygook that comes down from the places on high. And I was feeling pretty much powerless at the time I wrote this song. And I was trying to reflect that really it seems to be, it has gone on since the beginning of time. And even at the time of the Vietnam War, when there was so much protest in the air, I had a very fatalistic point of view. It seemed like all the protesting in the world wasn't going to change anything.
Long as I remember, the rain been coming down, clouds of mystery forest, confusion on the ground.
From people who were fighting in Vietnam that they played your records there a lot and that your records mattered to them while they were in the jungle?
I would hear that off and on right around the time of 1970-71, but I heard about it a lot more later as I began to become an adult. And guys who were now back and settled into the community would tell me all kind of stories about Vietnam and the music that they experienced there.
And what did that mean to you?
Well, in some cases, it was very uplifting. I am proud that the songs meant so much. You know, I realized, of course, that all the music at the time meant so much, and especially to Americans off in a foreign land, in a jungle, fighting for their life. I mean, anything, these are kids, these are guys 20 and 21 years old. Anything that is a touch of home is a very welcome memory at that time.
John Fogerty was the lead singer of Creedence Clearwater Revival. He spoke to Terry in 1998. His new CD, Deja Vu All Over Again, is being released this month.